Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This week's episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, a full-service regulatory compliance consulting firm serving the ambulatory surgery industry, and Eden Group Development, publisher of the ASC Regulatory Compliance series of books by John Gailey. Welcome to episode 10 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. For the week of February 26th, 2018, I'm your co-host, Jenna Alvarez, here with John in our studio in Rochester, New York. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Jenna. It's great to be back in the studio again. I was on the road quite a bit last week, which greatly complicates our scheduling of the podcast and putting it all together. So it's great to be in the same place as the co-host for once.
Yeah, same here. So there hasn't been a ton of news in the industry this week, but here's what we have. The CMS released a statement this week, well, last week, stating that they are granting exceptions to ASCs affected by natural disasters. Due to the devastating impacts of several natural disasters that have happened recently, the CMS is granting exceptions for Medicare quality reporting requirements to ASCs located in affected areas. This includes areas affected by the California wildfires, as well as areas affected by Hurricane Nate. ASCs located in these areas, all of which have been designated by the Federal Emergency Management Agency as major disaster localities, will receive exceptions without having to submit any extraordinary circumstances exceptions requests. ASCs located outside of these areas may request an exception.
And Jen, I think we need to point out too that they're granting exceptions with regard to reporting Medicare quality reporting elements that are due within the next couple months.
And slightly older piece of news, but we're going to cover it now anyways, was a memorandum from CMS as well, which was a clarification of accrediting organization's role when a provider or supplier's deemed status has been temporarily removed. In summary, after a temporary removal of deemed status, it is imperative that CMS notifies the appropriate accrediting organization when deemed status is removed and a provider or a supplier is placed under state survey agency jurisdiction. CMS will not accept any accreditation decisions or recommendations made by the accrediting organization based on a Medicare accreditation survey conducted while the provider or the supplier is under state survey agency jurisdiction. Temporary removal of deemed status is an acceptable reason for the delayed conduct of a triennial survey. Once deemed status is restored, the accrediting organization is expected to delay the triennial survey for a reasonable period of time to ensure the integrity of an unannounced survey.
So, Jenna, what this actually is referring to is those situations when a state agency comes in and finds the organization is not meeting the standards after the Joint Commission has already, or AAHC or any of the accrediting organizations have inspected. And what this does is it gives them a period of time in which the accrediting organization basically backs off and then the state agency steps in to continue the survey until they have cleared up all of those items. And then it kind of resets that time frame or allows the accrediting organizations to set a new time frame for the surveys after that point. You might recall within our company, we've had a couple of our clients that have come in that have they've hired us after they've gotten into trouble with one of the accrediting organizations, and we've had to deal with this type of thing. So I think what CMS is doing here is just clarifying what they've been doing, in fact.
Well, thank you for your clarification to the clarification. Well, John, since we didn't have a lot of news this week, why don't you tell us about what you've been up to?
Sure. Well, as you know, because you've been sick also, I've been kind of out under the weather for a while and laid up with cold and allergies. Which has been one of the reasons that we're having so many problems recording this episode and why we don't sound our normal cheerful people. But last week I did get to visit three facilities. I did two mock surveys and held two quality assurance meetings and one board meeting.
So slow week.
A slow week, right. Something interesting did come up during one of those visits. And Jenna, you actually did some follow-up on that one.
You must be referring to the non-discrimination regulations.
That's correct. I am indeed. And before we go further, I don't know that we have properly introduced Jenna to our podcast listeners. Jenna, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do outside of co-hosting this podcast?
Sure. Well, I'm a senior nurse consultant with Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. I've been with the company since October, but I worked with them as a private contractor for about 5 years prior to joining it full time.
And can you tell your tell our listeners what you do for AHS?
Sure. Well, I guess you could call me the policy guru. I review the regulations and accreditation standards and work with our clients to make sure that their policy manuals are compliant and then remain compliant as the regulations and the standards change. I also do the annual reviews of our client policy manuals and review new client manuals as we're onboarding them, making sure that there's not anything that we need to revise.
Right, and given the extraordinary growth of AHS over the past year, that indeed has not been an easy task.
Yes, indeed. But we did just hire another senior nurse consultant to help out, so that'll be exciting. I also visit our clients, gather information for the QAPI, or the quality improvement process, summarize the information, prepare the meeting agendas for the QAPI meetings, and once the meeting's done, I write up the minutes.
And I should probably point out that Jenna is my daughter and has literally grown up in the ASC business. She used to go with me on weekends when I would do some work at the center.
Well, if I remember right, I went there mainly because you had the freezer pops in the post-op lounge that I really enjoyed.
Oh, so the truth finally comes out after all these years. But you did do a summer internship at one of my centers, and that's how you decided to become a nurse.
Yep.
And now it's great to be working with you both as a consultant and as a podcast host. So this week I did a mock survey and noticed that the facility didn't have any of the documentation for the non-discrimination regulations. And I need to point out that this is actually not part of the conditions for coverage. So it generally is not included in a CMS-type survey, but it is definitely a requirement, a federal requirement that the organizations have to meet. And Jenna, can you give our listeners a little background information about the regulations? And then I will finish with the discussion of its regulatory implications for the ASCs.
Sure. So I'm going to read from Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act. And the major point of this section is to prohibit discrimination based on race, color, national origin, sex, age, or disability in certain health programs and activities or in covered entities. And this basically covers anyone who's accepting Medicare or Medicaid. It's got a couple sections. First one of which is to prohibit sex discrimination in healthcare. The second prohibits discrimination of individuals based on their disabilities and requires them to provide appropriate auxiliary aids and services. And the third requires entities to take reasonable steps to provide meaningful access to each individual with limited English proficiency eligible to be served or likely to be encountered in their health program or activity. In addition, it encourages entities to develop and implement a language access plan. It also requires entities with 15 or more employees to have a grievance procedure in place and to have a designated compliance coordinator. The final rule requires all covered entities to post notices of non-discrimination and taglines that are to alert individuals with limited English proficiency to the availability of language assistance services. There is actually on the HHS website these taglines, these notices, and a statement of non-discrimination available in 64 different languages. So I encourage you to check that out if you haven't already. The ruling also requires covered entities to post taglines in at least the top 15 non-English languages spoken in the state in which the entity is located or does business. And those are also the 15 languages by state are also available on the HHS website.
And Jenna, I think we'll put a link on the our website to that that thing for our readers to see.
Okay, great. And the final rule also requires entities to post a non-discrimination statement in at least the top two non-English languages spoken by individuals with limited English proficiency in that state on any significant communications such as postcards. And those, like I said, are also available on the website. So, John, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, certainly. Well, that's a lot to absorb, of course. I think the biggest issue that I found, you know, the anti-discrimination or the non-discrimination against individuals, that's been around for a while. What's different about what happened in 2016 with this regulation is the requirement to post a sign with those taglines, as you mentioned, that in the waiting area, that basically allows a patient who can't speak English to come up, point to one of the taglines, and basically say, "This is the language I speak," which gives the receptionist the ability to figure out to determine which service they will have to contract with. So when I visit a facility, when a surveyor comes into a facility, we should be able to see a sign posted in the waiting area that would allow non-English speaking individuals to point this out to the receptionist.
And it also requires them to post that notice in English. It's available on the HHS website, and it's also available in all 64 languages. But the one that is in English, you need to post and put your contact information in for your coordinator so that if an individual feels that they need to make a complaint that they have been discriminated against, they have the contact information for both your administrator, your coordinator, and the HHS as well.
As I noted earlier, this is not part of the Medicare conditions for coverage, so it's not directly covered in a survey. However, it is a federal requirement, and failure to adhere to it can subject the organization to fines and, of course, all kinds of penalties if a patient does complain about their rights not being met here. It will not be picked up on most surveys, but it certainly could.
Okay, well, let's take a short break, and we'll come back to explore the registration process.
Sounds good.
Good morning, Mr. Targaryen. Welcome to Westeros Surgery Center. How are you doing today?
Well, truthfully, I'm a bit nervous. I would much rather be doing just about anything else other than having surgery here today.
Well, don't you worry, Mr. Targaryen. We are all here to make you as comfortable as possible. You have nothing to worry about. Can I start by asking you for your ID?
Sure. Here you go.
Thank you. Now, can you tell me what procedure you're here for today?
Oh my God, you don't know what I'm here for? What type of organization is this? What if I told you I was here for a lobotomy? Would you just do a lobotomy without even checking to see if I needed one?
I'm so sorry, Mr. Targaryen. We ask these questions just for your safety. Just to make sure all of our paperwork from the doctor's office and your paperwork agree. We take safety very seriously here at the surgery center, and we double-check, triple-check everything. You'll actually be asked the same question several times before your surgery, just to make sure everyone agrees as to what's going to be done.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. I guess I'm more than a little nervous. I'm here for a colonoscopy.
That's great, and indeed that's what we have you down here for. Now, I'm going to ask you to read and sign a number of documents that we are required to give you by state and federal regulation.
No problem.
The first document here is our Statement of Patients' Rights and Responsibilities. This basically explains to you your rights and responsibilities as a patient here at the surgery center. You should have been given a copy of this at the physician's office when you were scheduled for your surgery.
Yes, I recognize it.
Do you have any questions?
No, but does it have to be so long?
I'm sorry, it pretty much is dictated to us by our regulators and accrediting organization. Next here is our patient privacy notice. It describes our policies regarding how we protect your health information and provides information on how and when it can be released. Do you have any questions about that?
Isn't this the same as the last document that we looked at? You know, the patient rights and responsibilities. Right here at the top, it says, your information, your rights, our responsibilities.
I know it seems similar, but the beginning of the privacy notice addresses your rights and responsibilities as it relates to your protected health information.
Oh, now I understand. No, I don't have any other questions.
Next is the disclosure of ownership interest. Your surgeon today is one of the owners here at the surgery center, and both he and we are obligated to disclose that.
Okay.
Next comes all of our financial disclosures and your agreement that you are responsible for the cost of the surgery if the insurance company is not willing to pay.
Oh, they've approved everything. No problem. Where again do I sign?
Right here. And lastly, our advance directive policy. First of all, do you have a living will, healthcare proxy, or any other advance directive?
Oh my, why are you asking me a question like that? Are you telling me there's a chance I might die? Oh heavens, I didn't know the procedure was that serious. Oh my lord, I'm going to die today, and I've never even seen an episode of that new talk show everyone's talking about. You know, the Game of Thrones.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Targaryen. I didn't mean to frighten you. We have to ask that question, and don't worry, you are in terrific hands here, and we are going to make sure you are as comfortable and safe as possible. The federal government and the state, however, require us to ask if you have any of those documents and to make sure that we make them part of your file. We are also required to tell you that if you were to have a major incident where you stopped breathing or your heart stopped beating, we would take all necessary precautions to bring you back.
Oh, I understand. I'm so sorry. I guess I really am nervous. I'll be okay. So let's talk about the scenario that we just saw. So first of all, as you can see, our receptionist really did an excellent job in making sure that the patient was well-informed prior to the procedure of all of his rights and responsibilities, the advance directives, the patient privacy, financial disclosures, et cetera, you know, including ownership. What's important for us to understand here is that position actually carries a lot of responsibility. That is, the position of the receptionist carries a lot of responsibility for making sure that we carry out several of the conditions for coverage. So 41650 of the condition for coverage for patient rights states, the ASC must inform the patient or the patient's representative or surrogate of the patient's rights and must protect and promote the exercise of these rights as set forth in this section. The ASC must also post the written notice of patient rights in its place or places within the ASC likely to be noticed by patients waiting for treatment or by the patient's representative or surrogate if applicable. And it goes on to state under 50A, Notice of Rights, an ASC must, prior to the start of the surgical procedure, provide the patient or the patient's representative or patient surrogate with verbal and written notice of the patient's rights in a language and manner that ensures the patient, the representative, or the surrogate understand all the patient rights as set forth in the section. The ASC's Notice of Rights must include the address and telephone number of the state agency to which patients may report complaints, as well as the website for the Office of the Medicare Beneficiary Ombudsman. So a couple things to note with regard to this standard. It requires the facility to notify the patient with verbal and written notice of the patient rights. So you notice that we sometimes forget that there has to be verbal notification in some way also. Usually this is interpreted as asking the patient to read the notice and ask if they have any questions. Certainly if the patient does not speak English or speaks a language where you do not have a copy of the privacy notice in that language, that notice will have to be read to the patient by the interpreter. So that is the rule, and you know, there's an expectation that you would follow through with it. Note that there is there's two separate documents that we're talking about when we're talking about rights. We're talking about the patient rights and responsibilities and a privacy notice. Those are two separate documents, and both of those must be available at your registration desk to hand to the patient, even if the patient has been given those notices prior to the date of surgery. For example, if you mail them to them or if they were given in the physician's office prior to the surgery. So make sure you have extra copies of these available if you don't give them to the patient. Now, we all know that most patients actually do not wish to keep a copy of that, and that's perfectly fine, but you have to be able to offer it. Now, the patient rights and responsibility does need to be posted, as you heard, in an area or in areas where the patient was likely to see it, as well as all their representatives. If the doctor is an owner of the surgery center in which the surgery is being performed, he has to notify the patient prior to the surgery that he is an owner. And that disclosure that you just heard is an appropriate disclosure. The patient, of course, does have a right to choose another physician if they have a concern about the patient, about the physician being an owner there. So it really is smart to make sure that the patient is notified prior to the date of surgery, hopefully in the physician's office, about this ownership situation. And lastly, the advance directive. Now, this is often the more confusing area for people. Some facilities actually state that they do not accept advance directives. If you have that included in your policy or you state that to the patient, that is actually a violation of their patient rights. A patient has a right to be able to tell an organization what they wish to do, give them directives as to what they wish to do if they're no longer able to make decisions on their own. So, an advance directive is any notification that the patient provides to the facility prior to the procedure with regard to the way they wish to be treated when they no longer are able to make decisions on their own. This can include and often includes things like healthcare proxies or living wills. Where we're most concerned, however, here is if one of those directives is a DNR or a do not resuscitate order. Most ambulatory surgery centers do not honor do not resuscitate order on the date of the surgery or during the surgical procedure, simply because if a patient is undergoing anesthesia, they might be taken too far down in their anesthesia as a result of the anesthesia, and they might stop breathing or might have a situation where their heart stops. And most anesthesiologists will want to intervene at that point in order to bring them back to the situation or the position they were in prior to that procedure starting. Which would mean that they would not honor a DNR order. It is a requirement, it is a condition of coverage with CMS that we notify the patient, however, of what the advance directives are and make sure that they understand that they will be resuscitated if that is the case during the procedure, regardless of what DNR order might be in place. It's also important to remember that a patient can refuse to let us put the DNR order down. So if they say, no, I will not allow the DNR order to be put down during the procedure, then it would probably be appropriate for us to say, you know, this is not the appropriate place for us to perform this procedure. We can give you the names of other organizations or other places where this procedure can be performed. So we hope with this scenario that we just provided to you, you can see what a good receptionist discussion with the patient would be. You might even want to let them listen to this example so that they can see all of those elements that need to be included in a registration. Now, I know that that might mean that these registrations are taking longer than you do right now, but in order to meet the requirements, you need to make sure that all of those elements that we showed are included as part of the registration process. So we're going to take a short break right now and return with the question of the week. So on to our last segment of the show where we take listener questions. We had a question from a listener this week about transporting instruments from the operating room to the instrument cleaning room. The listener asked, I need some help as far as transporting soiled instruments from the operating room to the decontamination in the sterile processing department. Is it mandatory to be transported in a biohazard container, or can it be transported on top of the table as long as it is draped? Please let me know, and I really appreciate your answer. So thank you for your question. So this is an issue that is foremost addressed as part of the OSHA Bloodborne Pathogen Standards. And I'm going to actually read the standards so you can hear exactly what their words are. And keep in mind that OSHA Bloodborne Pathogen Standards are mandatory. They're not optional at all. So you might adopt a standard that is more strict than what we're going to describe here, but this is the absolute bare minimum. So this is what the Bloodborne Pathogen Standard 1910.1030D28 states. Immediately or as soon as possible after use, decontaminated reusable sharps shall be placed in an appropriate container until properly reprocessed. These containers shall be puncture resistant, labeled or color coded in accordance with the standard, leak-proof on the sides and bottom, and reusable sharps that are contaminated with blood or other potentially infectious materials shall not be stored or processed in a manner that requires employees to reach by hand into the containers where these sharps have been placed. The Bloodborne Pathogen Standards are available, by the way, on the OSHA website, and there are also interpretive guidance there. So to meet the standard, you will need some type of rigid container into which the instruments are placed, which will not allow it to be leaked onto the floor. So clearly, putting it on top of a table that is rolled and draped and rolled into the sterile processing area is not appropriate. It does not meet the standard. The standard does not state a top is required, so a drape is sufficient, but again, it has to be a rigid container that doesn't allow any fluids to escape onto the floor. There is another part of the standard that does require that regardless of what type of cover is used, the transport apparatus must contain a biohazard warning sign. The requirement that an employee must not have to reach by hand into the container where sharps are processed is a bit problematic. So make sure that the sharps are not put into a deep container or that some other mechanism is used for removing them, such as a plastic bag, inside of that rigid container, which then can be pulled out. Note that other standards or your own standards or policies may and probably are more demanding or rigid, but this is the minimum standard under the OSHA Bloodborne Pathogen Standard. So that's it for another episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button on your podcast software so that you don't miss a single episode, and make sure you tell your friends and colleagues about the show. Have a great week.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute, legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. Our other sponsor today is Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including The Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage, and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascodcast.com.